This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I, and welcome to a brave new world in partnership with Donald Trump and Theresa May.
It's a movement like we've never seen anywhere in the world, they say.
What I am proposing cannot mean membership of the single market.
What will a Trump presidency have in store for the world? What will Brexit look like for us? I'm Georgie Frost. Joining me in the studio is editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss to talk through this and round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their award-winning website. And also on the agenda this week, the price of stuff is going up. I'm talking inflation, spenders hit, savers as well, as rates on savings accounts continue to fall.
I think there's a bit of a warning here for people to try and curb their spending a little bit, be a little bit more savvy about what they're spending their money on, because you never know what's around the corner with some of this stuff.
Is there any hope out there?
It's terrible. We look at the figures each month. We see all these savings rates cuts. And yes, in January, we've had some challenges raise rates, but they're by very small margins, like 0.1%.
If you weren't feeling despondent enough at that, we look at five rip-offs and financial wrongs that need to end, from ticket reselling at sky-high prices to sneaky credit card fees. Also today, Simon takes aim at car tax, and we find not one, but two car stories that even Rachel and I can comment on. And as Amazon tops a customer satisfaction table for the third time, we're not so happy with Npower, voted the worst energy company in Britain. Not the first, not the second, not even the fifth. The seventh year in a row. So I want to know, a very good morning, Simon, a very good morning, Rachel, who gets your votes, best and worst, please? A very good morning, Simon, to you first.
I think that the overall prize for worst customer satisfaction goes to the Great British Railways system.
Okay.
I think that what we've seen over the past year has been the culmination of many years of absolute 100% dedication to taking large amounts of money off people whilst treating them like absolute dirt. I mean, from the point where you step onto a train and you are treated as a criminal rather than a customer who basically needs to prove that they are not attempting to defraud the railway system, to the point where they don't tell you when the train is coming. In fact, interestingly, Thameslink swapped it around a while back so that instead of telling you what time the next train was and what time that train was going to arrive, so you could see how late it was, they now just tell you how many minutes until
yes.
it arrives.
And have you noticed,
which is
that's
sneaky,
two of the
isn't
longest
it?
Minutes
it's
you've
sneaky,
ever spent
really
in your
sneaky.
Life. That's not
well,
2 minutes.
Well, that's Transport for London minutes. They're not actual real minutes.
They're
relative.
Alex Ferguson
time
minutes.
Is relative on Transport for London. So what it tells you is not how long until the tube arrives, but how far the tube is away. So if that tube were to travel at the speed it's meant to travel, it would arrive with you in 3 minutes. But obviously something could happen in those 3 minutes that means that those 3 minutes actually take seven. And as a man who regularly gets tubes from High Street Kensington, I can tell you that time is definitely relative on Transport for London. And then the whole Southern debacle, I mean, it is astonishing, really. And the fact also that the taxpayer is picking up the tab for the Southern debacle, I mean, it just highlights how disastrous our privatisation of the railways has been. It is astonishingly incompetent. And what I love about it is that governments of varying hues have done absolutely nothing about it, whilst allowing people who basically, let's face it, are not getting trains because they want to get a train or because getting a train is particularly enjoyable or because they love the railways. We're not talking Michael Portillo here, basically, having a jaunt around the place. The vast majority of people getting these trains are basically going to work, and we have fundamentally let them down. So the British Railways, the British government, I tip my hat to you for the worst customer service ever over a prolonged period of time.
I feel like I need some classical music or something to calm you down. You know, when I was thinking of a way to describe this show, you know, I thought the Brave New World. The second option was the ranty episode. I really should have gone with that one first.
Do you want
of all.
Me to tell you my good customer service,
oh, thank
though?
Goodness, yes,
we'd do. Almost forgotten about that, hadn't we? I went on holiday in summer to France, and we drove to France, because we can no longer take aeroplanes because my eldest daughter is at school. And the one thing you realise...
It's another rant, Simon.
The one
Come
thing
on,
you realise when your children start school is you must now only drive on holiday. And we had the misfortune to break down.
Oh.
And Before we went away, I had taken out a European breakdown cover with the RAC. And I must admit, at the time, I'd been slightly annoyed about the cost of it because it did seem quite expensive. I mean, for 2 weeks, it was about double the price or triple the price of what I pay for an entire year's worth of cover in the UK. And I thought, you do need it. Mm. Don't ever think that and then not do it. And we broke down. We were without our car. They sent someone out and everything, put us up in a hotel. We couldn't get a hire car the next day because we were in France and everything was shut from the Saturday afternoon through to the Monday. But they said to us, if you can find another hire car, pay for it, you can claim it back off us. We had to get a train, change trains. We got the car. We had the car for 10 days because the garage didn't know how long it was going to take to fix our car. Anyway, basically, the RAC were amazing. A, they picked up the tab for all of this. And that insurance that cost us, I don't know, probably cost us about 90 quid, probably ended up saving us about a grand. We would have had to fork out well over a grand, I reckon, for all of this stuff. And B, they'd phone us up regularly just to check everything was okay and keep us informed. And beyond the fact that even they couldn't do anything about the fact that everything in France shuts down at midday on a Saturday and doesn't open up until 9 o'clock on a Monday morning, it was unbelievable. And they've given us the money back that we had to claim. There was no questions asked, no quibbling, no nothing like that. Absolutely brilliant. RAC, European breakdown cover, worth its weight in gold.
For me, much more simple than that. Best, well, you've totally taken the railways, and as a Southern Rail customer, I think I owned that one, by the way, but I'll let you have it. For me, worst, Santander, when I got defrauded. The best, Santander, when they finally managed to get round to sorting it out. The lady on the phone was marvellous. It felt like one-to-one service. So, Catherine, thank you very much from Santander. Rachel, for you?
My winner, it's a middle-class cliche, but John Lewis. You know that customer service is good when you look back on a mishap fondly. So I ordered a washing machine. It didn't turn up. No one told me what was going on. I was angry. And you know, when I get angry about consumer things, I'm ready to fight. Yeah. I phoned up and I was just completely appeased within about 2 minutes because they were so nice about it. They just said, look, that one's out of stock. Do you want to pick another one, sort of roughly in the same price range? And we'll get that over to you. And, you know, just let us know when's a good time to send it over. And so I got sort of, you know, next day delivery within a 2 hour time slot without paying the 20 quid excess that I would have had to have otherwise. And by the end of it, I thought, I just love John Lewis. And they'd really messed up, but it didn't matter because they turned it round. And for the baddie, it's got to be Taste Card. So Taste Card are these... a card you get, it costs...
You sign up for about £30, don't you? And then a certain number of restaurants, you can get half price deals
you
or
can, yeah.
two for one, it, or Simon's yeah. shaking his head.
You can go any time, except any time that anyone wants to go out for dinner. So not in December or Fridays or Saturdays. Basically, if you want to go to Pizza Express, that...
It is just really for Pizza Express, I have to say. It's a good job my dad is a big fan of Pizza Express, because in the 2 years I've got it, I've got the app, I've saved £348.
It tells you, that's good yeah. of them.
OK, my thing about, you know, some of these emails that you get from people, newsletters and such, telling you about deals at Pizza Express, is it actually possible to eat at Pizza
no.
Express or Pizza Hut or
no.
La Tasca without a deal? I mean, no. does anybody do this?
I did it on Friday and it just felt terrible because that was the only place around about and that's where the people I was with wanted to go to. And I was searching my phone for deals and thinking, surely we're not going to pay full price here, but we did.
My suggestion would be the next time you think about eating at Pizza Express, go find the independent pizzeria around the corner and go eat in there. And even if it costs you a little bit more, give a small business some money, not Pizza Express. They've got enough money.
Trump, May, who cares? It's all about Pizza Express.
This is Money, in partnership with NS&I. Have any premium bond prizes you win paid directly into your bank account.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to ShareAid, the team from the financial website of the year, This Is Money, are back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS&I. And I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And this week, we enter a brave new world. Indeed, the unthinkable became reality. The billionaire with no political experience, President Trump, is sworn in as Theresa May swears Britain out of the single market.
What we've done is so special. All over the world they're talking about it. And I love you folks, and we're going to work together, and we are going to make America great again, and I'll add, greater than ever before.
I want to be clear. What I am proposing cannot mean membership of the single market. We will pursue a bold and ambitious free trade agreement with the European Union. This agreement should allow for the freest possible trade in goods and services between Britain and the EU's member states.
So we now know Brexit means the UK will quit the single market and customs union. Parliament will vote on the final deal. Britain will leave without a trade deal if the EU cannot provide good terms. The UK will be free from European courts and there will be immigration controls on all EU citizens. Here's David Talbot of FTI Consulting.
This is definitely towards the harder end of it. The Prime Minister had hinted at her views last Sunday on Sky News, and also the Chancellor had given a very interesting interview to Germany's Develt newspaper 2 days before, kind of threw away his famously cautious approach and said the unfettered freedom of movement from the EU to the UK had to stop, expressly rejecting the political integration that membership of the EU had come to apply, and also stressed the desire to forge reciprocal trade agreements between London and Brussels. The big line was that, you know, if we're leaving the European Union, it is not compatible with still being a member of the single market and also the customs market as well. So out of the single market and looking, I think Theresa May's phrase was the best possible deal for the customs market. Other European, not EU, but other European countries do have access to the customs market, Turkey, for instance. So they will be looking at how they can guide these kind of post-Brexit trade deals. But certainly the initial reaction would be this is a hard, clean Brexit.
Well, that was David Talbot there of FTI Consulting. So a big week for the world. We'll head over to the other side of the pond first. Now, we've pored over, since Donald Trump was announced president-elect, haven't we, over this subject. But Simon, what will the presidency mean for, firstly, the world? How much of the rhetoric will become reality?
Well, I think that this comment has been made before, but I think the one thing that we know with Trump is that Trump means Trump. It means completely wild card, erratic behaviour, pronouncements, possibly a loose relationship with facts and the truth, depending on what he seems to think at any given moment, and a cast iron belief that as a very successful businessman, in his own words, that he is exactly the right kind of man to shake up the system, put the global elite in their place, and make America great again. And the priority is making America great again, not doing the rest of the world any favours. So it will be very, very interesting to see how that translates into Donald Trump, the president, because he's the president now. That's it. We've got to lump it. He is totally different to anything that we have seen as US president for a very, very long time, or any major country, apart from maybe Russia, where obviously Putin operates in a sort of similar kind of wild card fashion. And I mean, maybe being a wild card, there's nothing necessarily wrong with it. But I think what it means is that when it comes down to us and the pound in our pocket and how it's affected by the swings of global politics, you've got three scenarios. You've got the things just continue as they are. You've got the everything goes really badly, some form of global recession. Or you've also got the chance that everything goes great and Trump's right. Maybe we'll make America great again, and by making America great again, he'll make the world great again. So
reality
who knows?
Reality is you don't know. Did you forget your coin in your pocket again?
Yeah.
Like last week?
Yeah, well, no, the thing is you can't flip a coin for this one because
there's three sides.
Yeah. So I went to a really interesting, you know, investment outlook Tuesday this week being presented by Tom Beckett of Sigma Investment Management, and he put forward these three things. He was referring to Dante's Inferno because that's the kind of guy Tom is. But he said, you've got hell, you've got purgatory, you've got heaven. You've got these three options. And he said he puts them at about one third each.
Well, how do you deal with that? I mean, you're talking about markets here, but anyone, how do you deal with such uncertainty like that? Do you reckon this is going to impact long and short term, especially markets?
I think a degree of caution, possibly a degree more of caution than is being taken at the moment by many people for whom the only way is up. but also the willingness to take some risks, to be willing to look at things that you think, well, hang on a minute, that looks like it could do well, and to be willing to put a bit of money into it, but not to stake your house or your shirt or more money than you can afford to lose on these things. And actually, I think probably to start looking at things much more in detail and say, is this actually any good? And we've seen that this week, actually. Pearson, big profit warning, share price dropped 30%, cut its dividend. Now, Pearson is a UK-listed company that earns lots and lots and lots of monies in dollars. So it is exactly the kind of company that will have had its share price chased up by investors going, Brexit means pound falls against dollar, profits go up, and they're translated back into pounds and pence, buy that. And actually, it's turned out that Pearson has some underlying problems.
Rachel, I want to head to you now and ask generally, as Simon says, Trump means Trump and we could get three scenarios, but how much power will he really have? And I'm thinking here about Obama, and you remember the tears that he shed over Sandy Hook, desperate to change gun laws in America, didn't achieve that, desperate to shut Guantanamo Bay, that is still open. Those are just two examples. How much support will Donald Trump have to make these changes?
It's funny. He does things in a different way. I mean, he really needs to have the support of the House in order to make big decisions. But then he also kind of bypasses the system a lot of the time by tweeting and interacting with voters almost in person. So he can, we've seen, he moves share prices just by tweeting things. He has the capacity to do utterly chaotic things on the global scene.
And he's very thin-skinned as well, isn't he? Takes things really personally.
Oh, he gets very upset,
yeah.
Doesn't he?
Yeah. Someone take that Twitter account away from him, for goodness sakes. But in terms of materially, that pound in our pocket, will we feel it at all? Why should we care here what on earth goes on over there? Surely it's not going to impact me. Let America deal with that.
Well, it's a good point, but also you can't underestimate the importance of the states on the rest of the world. I mean, you only have to look to 2008 when a bunch of Americans started defaulting on their subprime mortgages to see what happens when things go wrong domestically for the states on the global scene. I look at it also more long term. It sounds a bit gloomy, but if he really starts to row back on some of the things that have been done towards minimising the effects of climate change, that's a global problem and it's a problem for the future as well, so can have a huge impact there. And also, I think that we've already seen the impact on the kind of Brexit deal that we have. I wonder when Michael Gove went over and got the first interview with Trump.
We got thumbs up, we got big smiles from Michael Gove. He's obviously optimistic, yeah.
And Trump said, "No, I love the Queen, my mum loves the Queen. You can definitely have a good Brexit deal." And I wonder whether Theresa May had that in the back of her mind when she said, you know what, we're going to remove ourselves from the single market. Just at the right time, she was given that boost from the US that it's not, you know, to the back of the queue with you, as Obama said to us before Brexit. But we've got Trump saying, I love you guys, thumbs up.
His mum loves the Queen. That's not a trade deal I want to be relying on.
You can totally have a good deal with us. So I think that maybe we're already seeing the impact of one man's personality on our economy.
Simon, I've got to go to you right now. You're laughing away there.
Well, I think that, I mean, from a purely strategically political point of view, it's unlikely that anyone's going to suddenly decide they don't like the Queen. So I think that's good.
Great. She'll be very pleased. But he's a big fan of protectionism.
He's a big fan of protectionism.
So how good a deal will we realistically get?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, are we really troubling America with some of the things that Donald Trump wants to protect? I mean, I'm pretty sure we're not going to be, like, seriously damaging the US domestic car market with our sales of Range Rovers and Jaguars and such like. But I think that the one thing you have to remember about pinning your hopes on a free trade deal with the US is that the US is a pretty inward-looking economy. It's a very, very big economy, but it is quite an inward-looking economy. And if it becomes an increasingly inward-looking economy, do you want to be pinning your trading hopes on it? Also, there is the small matter of, I know we live in a world of globalisation. A world of globalisation, there's one of those stupid things they tell you never to say in the style guide, isn't it? The world is global, yeah. You moron.
It's all right, Simon, it's all right.
The US is quite a long way away. And France is really close.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that difference between the two. We are already part of a very strong free trade bloc. So ditching that for another one. But I think that what's important is that, you know, what Theresa May has said is we still want to be able to trade freely with Europe. OK, we want to be able to strike these deals with America and still trade freely with Europe. And just to go quickly back to the why does the US thing matter to us here? If you look at the FTSE global market, so basically the size of all the stock markets in the world, America makes up 53% of that whole thing and we make up 6%. So there's your answer as to why it matters.
Well, Simon touched on it there, Rachel. Theresa May's plans, we got 12 points to her plan to leave the EU. What did you make of them? What was she saying?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I shouldn't really be commenting on this because it's thanks to the meddling of the media and our speculation on what Brexit might mean.
Move on to savings rates.
But sorry for expressing my opinion on this, but since you asked, thank you, Georgie. She told us a lot more than we've heard up until now, and she sort of had to because there was a lot of talk of, you know, maybe, Theresa maybe. And she really gave us these 12 points about what might happen. The most crucial one, as you say, is that she doesn't want to remain in the single market, but yes, she does want a very... her rhetoric was very positive towards our trading with the European Union. I thought of it as in terms of the language of divorce, it sounded like to me. And she became sort of the grown-up who wanted to say, look, let's be grown-up about this here.
Let's think about the kids.
Yeah, and what's bad, you know, if we make this difficult, then that's not good for anyone. So I just want an amicable breakup here. We're going to have boundaries, but I think that we should all get along. And that's sort of what she was saying. Totally the grown-up approach to the whole situation. And really setting it up so that if... there is any kind of squawking by the EU over it, first of all, she'll see it as an act of self-harm. And second, it's obvious that they're being the children because she's the one who's acting professionally about it all.
Was there squawking, Simon? What's the response been over the channel?
Well, the temptation is to be a bit glib about the whole thing and say that Theresa May basically stood up and did this thing where she said, we're going to leave your club. However, we would still like to use parts of your club. And if you don't let us use them, we're leaving. But we will still come back and use those bits. But we're not paying for them and no arguing, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, to an extent, does characterise the speech slightly. However, I think Theresa May is really smart. I think she's quite a lot smarter than most people give her credit for. I also think that she was right. She is 100% right. We have voted to leave the EU. Now, you can argue all you want about the vote and the, how it was done and who said what and all those other things, but we had a referendum. The question, unfortunately, was remain or leave. The question, unfortunately, did not include some stuff about, and if you do make a decision one of those ways, what would you actually like to do? Thus illustrating that perhaps we possibly should have thought through the referendum a little bit more. But that was the question. We gave an answer, and now the government is doing what people voted for. Quite rightly so, to be perfectly honest. And Theresa May is absolutely right in saying, you know, we voted to leave. This is what our people voted for. And this is what's going to happen. And we need to make sure that we basically come to the best possible amicable mutual agreement here because it is in everybody's best interest.
Yeah, you know, she says no deal is better than a bad deal. But realistically, though, can they just go, well, if we don't get a deal, we're walking away?
Well, yeah, of course they could. Of course we could do that. What, the world's not going to end. We were not a member of the EU for many, many hundreds of years, and we could survive many, many hundreds of years of not being members of the EU. The EU was brought together as a free trade project that then morphed into something very, very different. And the problem with Europe has been that it has rigidly stuck to rules that it basically created for scenarios that had not occurred yet. And when those scenarios have occurred, it's actually been discovered that some of those rules don't work very well. But instead of doing something to change those rules, it has decided that it will continue to rigidly stick to the rules. And that is true of the Eurozone crisis and all of the stuff going on with the ECB. It is true of the euro. It's very much true of what's gone on in Greece. And Greece has suffered an awful, awful amount due to this extreme rigidity that's going on here. And it's now happening, you know, with Brexit. And there is definitely a sentiment in Europe amongst the European leaders of we must punish the Britons because otherwise, what if somebody else wants to leave? Well, do you know what? If somebody else wants to leave and they have a referendum to leave, then let them leave. That is the decision of the people. We joke about Theresa May, you know, talking about just wanting to wander into the club and wander out of the club and use what she wants. But that's better than putting everyone in a prison that you tell them they can't leave. And that is ultimately what this idea of punishing people for leaving leads towards. And so, yes, I think it would be very much in the EU's best interests and Britain's best interests if everyone grew up a little bit. And I think that was primarily the message of Theresa May's speech.
Talking about leaving, though, I do want to mention about the banks that are saying that they're going to move out of the city. HSBC, didn't we? UBS, JP Morgan as well. Should they be concerned about that?
Yeah, maybe, but really? Are they going to really leave? The banks are always threatening to leave London. They threaten to leave London at the drop of a hat. You know, I'm surprised they don't wake up in the morning and complain about the fact that it's been raining for 5 days in a row. You know, say, right, we're definitely moving our headquarters out of London unless somebody does something about this. So, yes, there is a concern. There's concerns around passporting and things like that. But London has a long and illustrious history as a financial centre. And that will ebb and flow. You know, over the last three decades, it's been on the up as one. I don't doubt that over some point in the rest of my life, it will be, you know, on the downward slope as one. But it will still remain a major financial centre because it's slap bang in the middle of the time zone between Asia and the US. People like living in London. It's one of the world's greatest cities. We have basically carved out this reputation for the kind of rule of law and property ownership and all those other things. We're a great trading nation. And also, we speak English.
Yeah.
And basically, that's everyone's second language. So there you go. That's why London's going to remain a major financial centre. So maybe if some bank jobs leave, it will do us a favour. We might do a bit more of that manufacturing stuff we were going to rebalance the economy towards.
Simon, you are on fine form today.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
This is Money Editor Simon Lambert and Personal Finance Editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss in with me. So what else can we blame on Brexit? Marmite, Apple apps going up in price, spenders continuing to be hit by the Brexit pound. But is it fair to blame the vote to leave the EU on rising prices?
I think it is unfair. I mean, you've got to bear in mind, over the pound exchange rate, the pound was at about 1.7 to the dollar couple of years ago, and it has been gradually declining. Brexit has carried on that trend, and I suspect for many companies, Brexit was probably the last straw. They've managed to sort of absorb the increasing prices from the decline of the pound over the last couple of years, and Brexit probably just pushed that a bit far. And so probably I do have, you know, a certain degree of sympathy with companies sort of finally thinking, well, let's put this through, albeit they're probably, I mean, it was probably quite difficult for Unilever to justify Marmite, I think, given that that was actually produced in this country. But probably the other ones, like washing powder increases and things like that, which are more have got an element of commodity prices and oil prices, were probably more justified.
That was inflation expert Pete Cumley there. As inflation rose more than expected this week too, hitting spenders and savers in turn, and coming up, This Is Money has revealed the best and worst ISA savings accounts. But the price of stuff, as measured by the CPI, increased from 1.2% to 1.6% in December, blamed on higher food prices and airfares. Here's our reporter Tom Hill.
There's been some particular things that are contributing to this 1.6% figure. Petrol and fuel prices linked to this OPEC production deal all been pushed up. But one of the key things really is food and consumer goods linked to the fall in the value of the pound. That has been one of the key things pushing up prices, and that's why we're seeing this greater than expected jump to 1.6%. Previously, the sort of median forecasts were around 1.4%, so this has defied expectations. And whilst this is still under 2%, this is still quite early on into this whole post-referendum economy going forward, particularly with growing uncertainty around what direction Theresa May is going to take Brexit. This uncertainty that's fueling the decline in the value of the pound, this is something that could continue. I mean, previously, the Bank of England has admitted that 2017 could see this 2% target easily being exceeded. And the fact that even these early forecasts are being beaten this early into the year shows we could be on our way to that.
So, Rachel, more pressure on that pound in our pocket. Why has it gone up so much, inflation? More than expected.
It is. I mean, it's still below what the Bank of England aims for, which is 2%. But what is surprising is just how quickly it's getting up to that 2%. And therefore, the chances of it overshooting that are increasing as well. It's not surprising, really, that it's happened because of this huge fall in the value of the pound. We buy lots of stuff from elsewhere. We're buying in dollars and we're spending in sterling, it's going to cost more. The same with euros. So we've seen a bit of that has come from food prices. We've also seen an increase in fuel prices as well. That's been a massive influence. But the one that I think is really an indicator of where things are going are the prices paid for factories for raw materials and energy jumped by 15.8% over the last year. If you're paying more for raw materials, you're going to have to recoup your costs in some kind of way. And it's just a matter of how and when manufacturers choose to pass those costs on. So we'll probably be protected a little bit because of how price sensitive we are. It's still a difficult market. It will be difficult for any retailer to start putting up prices, as we saw with Tesco and Marmite. But this is going to happen. And I suppose as some do it, and we feel more comfortable with the idea that that's kind of the direction of travel, that's what's happening, prices are going up, it will be easier for others to follow. The other side of the equation, which is just as important, is how much money we've got. It's all right if the cost of stuff is going up, if we've got more money to pay for it. And we had employment figures out and also wage figures. And I think wage growth was slightly higher than expected. So again, from that perspective, we're sort of protected for a while as well. Different matter, though, for savers.
Yeah, we'll get on to savers in a minute. But you actually spoke to Steve Keen, didn't you? Professor of Economics at Kingston University, author of Debunking Economics for Big Money Questions. You were discussing debt, household borrowing. What came of that out of that chat?
Utter horror and fear.
OK, great.
Yeah. He's very worried about high levels of consumer debt and made a good argument as to why that was more of a concern for more of a danger to the economy than any kind of government debt. That a lot of the growth that we've been seeing has been fueled by debt, and you can't keep going like that forever. People can't just they've been proving that you can, but there must surely come a point at which people can't stretch themselves any further. It's okay now because interest rates are so low, money is very cheap. So people can afford to service their debts. It's not that big a deal. As soon as interest rates start to go up, that's going to be a problem. We are banking very heavily as a country, as we talk about all the time, on the value, the perceived value of our homes, and have huge debt piles, a lot of us, in the expectation that those prices will manage to sort of sustain themselves over the course of now coming up to 30, 35 years sometime mortgage terms. So, yeah, he's a bit worried about it all. Less worried about government debt, interestingly.
Interesting. But how worried are you with all of this coming together at this time?
Everything seems quite carefully balanced at the moment. Mm. People aren't really defaulting on loans. We don't see sort of repossessions of homes as we have done in many sort of periods in the past. But we, again and again, we just get these little indicators that things, as soon as they start to go wrong, we're going to have a problem on our hands. We had a report a few months ago from the FCA saying that 5 million credit cards will never be repaid because people won't have the money to do so. As soon as rates start to go up, it's fine for now. But as those costs go up, people are going to realise just what they've got on their hands. So, I don't know. I'd be paying down debts if at the moment. I should really overpay my mortgage, shouldn't I? Practice what I preach.
Well, while Rachel muses on her own personal finances, Simon, your views?
Potentially you should, but arguably you shouldn't when interest rates are that low, Rachel, if you're willing to take a gamble. So your mortgage rate is what, like 2.5% or something higher, lower?
A little bit lower,
right? Now, if you worked on the basis that you thought you could get a 5-6% real return from the stock market, you'd actually be better off investing that money every month. But basically the return you'd get from your mortgage is guaranteed, whereas the return you get from the stock market could obviously swing around wildly and you might end up 20% down in any given year. So it all depends on how much risk you want to take. Unfortunately, the general population doesn't tend to weigh up stuff in that kind of way, and so are largely better off having much less debt. The real problem for people always comes when is actually that the crunch point with debt, and this happens for companies and individuals, is because they always think that they will be able to refinance at the end of a loan term deal at basically about the same rate. And what happens is when they suddenly find they can't do it. And that's what happened in the financial crisis. You know, our love of 2-year fixed rate mortgages in this country. Everyone thought they, and their brokers told them, don't worry, 2 years' time, you'll be able to, you know, remortgage, same rate, rates might even be lower. And actually what happened is they discovered that they couldn't. And part of that was because interest rates had gone up slightly. Part of it was because banks just didn't want to lend anyone any money. So they shoved up interest rates independent of the base rate. And part of it was also because, like, they chopped a load of the really small loan-to-value deals. So basically, if you had 40% equity in your home, then you were absolutely fine. But if you had, you know, 5 or 10% equity, then you were in real trouble. And for the people who took out the Northern Rockstar Together mortgages and had no equity and actually had borrowed 120%, then you had a massive issue. So that's where people get caught out. And that's where people might get caught out in these 0% balance transfers.
Exactly what I was about to say.
What happens if suddenly the 0% balance transfer market just evaporates?
Yeah.
At the moment, you could get a 0% balance transfer that lasts for 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's crazy that a credit card company will lend you money for 3.5 years. If a credit card company ever offers to lend you money for 3.5 years, ask why the credit card company is offering to lend you 0% interest money for 3.5 years.
Why are they doing
it? Because enough people don't pay back the debt in 3.5 years that the credit card company makes a load of money. You know, it's a trap to get those people who don't pay it off properly. I think the debt thing is a huge issue. I think it's the personal debt is a big issue. But the thing about the personal debt is it's unsecured. You know, at the end of the day, you're in trouble if you walk away from it, but you can walk away from it. Mortgage debt's a big problem. You can't get away from that one. Even if you default and the bank repossesses your house and sells it for less than it's worth, you can end up without a house and still on the hook for the debt. And, you know, first-time buyers buying flats and you know, in London for 500 grand on an 80% mortgage, they've got 400 grand's worth of debt. It's a lot of money.
Rachel?
Our attitude to debt suggests that we're a nation of incredible optimists, because that's really what taking out debt requires, that you have to believe that you will have more money in the future than you have now, that you'll be able to take in your everyday spending and then a bit extra to repay the debt as well. Yes, we're seeing it through credit card deals and their extended terms, but also an increase in debt, you know, buy 6 months free credit, all that kind of stuff. And what I didn't realise actually that a lot of them do is if you miss one payment towards the end of the term, they charge you interest for the whole previous term when you ought to have been paying. So it's when you're really stung that you're going to get walloped with the interest from before as well. And so many people will take out these deals because they think, well, of course I'll be able to pay this off. And most people can, and then that's fine. But if there's a chance that you can't, you know, you don't know what's going to happen in the future if you, you know, have unexpected costs or you get made redundant or something like that. It's at that point that you're then told that you have to pay all of the interest from the whole term.
It's okay, Rachel, though, because we're encouraged to save, aren't we? No, we're not. That's a complete lie. It's a complete lie. We've spoken about inflation's impact on spenders, but what about savers? We heard this week that just 44 of the 669 savings accounts on the market can match inflation, but most have withdrawal restrictions. That's according to MoneyFacts, who say banks slashed 84 accounts last month, hitting those who rely on interest for day-to-day living the hardest. Now, interest rates on some saving accounts were cut 0.6% in December. Of course, the current Bank of England base rate is 0.25%. Here's Rachel Springall from MoneyFacts.
It's terrible. I mean, we look at the figures each month. We see all these savings rates cuts. And yes, in January, we've had some challengers raise rates, but they're by very small margins, like 0.1%, which makes very little difference. So the majority of the savings rates right now are falling, which makes it increasingly more difficult for people to get a good return. With inflation on the rise, and at the moment, it's 1.6, it's expected to go much higher than that this year, and that's going to make it really, really difficult for people who rely on their savings pot.
So what can savers do?
You need to just kind of change your mindset on how you save. So traditionally you put some money in an easy access account. Stop thinking about that, because are you actually going to be touching that cash? If you are, then fine, leave some in there. But if not, spread your cash across current accounts. They're paying much better rates. Spread your cash across regular savers. If you have a goal, they pay so much better. And just get the best interest possible. Don't stay with your bank. Loyalty does not pay.
From one Rachel Springall from MoneyFacts to another Rachel, it's been a rubbish old time, hasn't it, for savers? I mean, we're talking about cuts there. You've also compiled a list of the worst paying ISAs as well. But there's some good news for NS&I. Tell us more.
Yeah, by and large, savings accounts don't beat inflation. That means that the value is being eroded. You'd be just as good putting it under your mattress at the moment. One in four, don't really, but one in four pay less than 0.25%. I mean, that's embarrassing. Surely they should be embarrassed at that. That you know, you put in a grand and you get less than a quid. It's just terrible. But yeah, NS&I is slightly, well, it's not that good, but it's better than the others. So it's sort of managed to...
Is there Easy Access Direct to ISA, is this right? Paying 1%?
Yeah, which is top of the lot.
The highest rate in a variable account, which is somewhat depressing.
So it's just sort of managed to float to the top by virtue of the others sinking, really.
You love your lists at This Is Money as well. Five rip-offs, if that's made you feel a bit depressed. You've got five rip-offs and financial wrongs that need to end, you say, from ticket reselling at sky-high prices to sneaky credit card fees. And you even have a manifesto explaining how to deal with them and create a financially better 2017. So, Rachel, can I come to you for about 90 seconds on this?
We have got, at number one, stop the ticket reselling con. This is terrible when ordinary fans don't stand a chance of getting
sound
tickets.
Sound more angry, Rachel. Come on. That's it. Much better.
There you are. Ludicrous credit card and transaction fees. I can't do that in 90 seconds. I'm going to get too angry. Fine. Stop outrageous train ticket price rises. At the moment, I'd say any price rise is outrageous with the state of the trains as they are. Freeze cold calling, cold texting and cold emailing and increase the fines. I totally agree with that. I don't know that there's any good reason why we should allow someone to phone you up out of the blue and say, I want to help you with your pension. Loyalty should be rewarded. Never is. And it's never going to happen. But it would be nice to dream.
Wouldn't it just? OK, so that's five. Simon, you've picked on one specifically. We're going to stick with rants. You see the theme of this. You've been tapping away on your laptop. Why? Why has Simon been tapping away? I hear you cry. What has attracted his ire this week? It's nothing to do with Trump, nor Brexit, nor even parking around Islington. No, it is...
car tax.
There we go. Tell us more.
Well, the car tax system is changing. We reported on this at the time, but then everyone seemed to sort of largely forget it. And basically, this was one of George Osborne's sort of little bits of magic medicine that he delivered in the post-election budget of July 2015. If you remember the heady days of 2015, the year when we got not one, not two, but three budgets from the former Chancellor in the form of the budget, the post-election budget, and then the autumn statement that was really a budget. And he tinkered around with the car tax. Now, car tax, since 2001, has basically been graded on CO2 emissions. So the more your car pollutes on CO2, the more you pay, which a lot of people don't really like it, but at least it's got a bit of logic behind it. It did, however, succeed in actually doing what it was meant to do and encouraged people away from high CO2 emitting cars. And the way it did this is because it massively favoured diesels. So we went from being a nation of devout petrol-buying drivers and looking at all these strange, funny foreigners over the channel in Europe driving all these diesels to basically, at one point, buying more than 50% of new cars that were diesels. Unfortunately, it turned out this was slightly misguided and that whilst the diesels were better for CO2 emissions, they were actually all poisoning us with nitrogen oxide emissions. And we haven't really dealt with that one properly yet at all. But anyway, the problem was this was too successful and it basically managed to get so many people into low CO2 emitting cars that the car tax take started to fall dramatically because all cars that emit less than 100 grams per kilometre of CO2 happen to get zero car tax. So George Osborne came up with a new plan and it was classic Osborne budgeteering. It has the whiff of something drawn up on the back of a cigarette packet on the morning of the budget about it. So There's also this thing called the showroom tax, which is first-year tax. That's going up. That will still be graded on CO2 emissions. After the first year, only 0% emission cars, complete 0% emission cars, will pay zero car tax. All of the rest of them will pay a flat rate of £140, unless they cost more than £40,000 new, at which point they will also, in years 2 to 6, the first 5 years after the first year, incur an extra £310. Quite why this completely arbitrary number of £40,000 was chosen, I'm not sure, but presumably it's because rich people buy cars over £40,000 and they're just fair game.
So in sum, Chancellor Lambert, what would you like?
Well, we should probably ditch this crazy system because you're going to read a lot more about this as it approaches, and it's got some wonderful anomalies in it, such as the fact that because a Ford Mustang, the 5-litre V8 Ford Mustang, costs £35,000 and so isn't over the £40,000 thing, after the first year, this car that emits a huge amount of pollution, does terrible miles to the gallon, is absolutely brilliant. We had one on test. Mustang, wonderful. And if you buy one, do buy the V8. We'll only pay £140 a year in car tax. That's the same as a Super Mini that hardly emits anything at all, and going to be far less than a £42,000 hybrid car, which will be incurring this huge extra tax. And so basically my suggestion is, why don't we just ditch this car tax altogether? Stick it on petrol. This has the wonderful fact of you just take the money you take from the car tax. I worked it back in homage to George Osborne. I did it on the back of an envelope. Basically, stick an extra 9.7p on fuel duty. We'd see our petrol prices go up by 11.6p. Highly unpopular, but if your petrol bill is currently £90 per month, it would add £8.70 a month or £104 a year, which is actually less than the £140 car tax. And it has the wonderful benefit that basically the more you drive, the more you pay, so it's environmentally friendly. And unbelievably,
flying,
I found
Simon.
Myself in the position where all these readers, 117 comments on it, and the vast majority of them said that they thought this was a good idea and commended me for it.
Oh,
I nearly fell off my chair repeatedly yesterday when I read these. I'm normally used to being lambasted by readers for being an idiot. I don't know what's going on. What's
been
turned upside
down.
Don't
worry, next week it'll be back to normal. The only reason I hurry you along there is because finally, Rachel, we found a couple of car stories that you and I can talk about. The first, this one's for you, Rachel, the most popular colour of car last year. 2.69 million new models were sold. It was...
White.
Yes, indeed. But the second, you've helpfully broadcast-proofed this for me. Should we go to a dinner party, Rachel, where talk of cars comes on the agenda? No longer can we look ignorant anymore. You have a list of the top 20 ones that we're pronouncing wrong. You've helpfully put the pronunciation next to it. I have sadly been handed a list of them without the pronunciation. So I'm just going to read a couple to you, Simon, and you can just go, or not. SsangYong Tivoli.
Yeah, pretty much right.
Much right is wrong in
pretty
my book.
Pretty much right.
How do you pronounce it?
I think it's the Tivoli. It's not the Tivoli. SsangYong bit that I think is the tricky bit. But I think you, broadly speaking, got that right.
Thank you. There's the VW Scirocco.
That's a Scirocco.
Right.
Yeah.
Completely
and you
wrong.
Cheated by not saying Volkswagen there, didn't you?
VW. Maserati Ghibli.
The Ghibli.
Right. The Renault Kadjar.
Kadjar.
Okay. The Lamborghini Huracan.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, good.
People say Hurricane, you see. That's where they get that one wrong.
The Maserati Quattroporte.
Quattroporte. And do you know what? What's brilliant about the Maserati Quattroporte is basically it means Maserati four-door, which just doesn't sound anywhere near as glamorous in English, does it?
Not at all. And finally, the Lamborghini Murcielago.
Yeah, that's right, actually. Although I always thought it was the...
Don't sound so surprised.
I always thought it was the Murcielago, but it's apparently, according to our pronunciation guide, it is the Murcielago.
Fabulous. Thank you, Editor Simon Lambert, Personal Finance Editor Rachel Rigard-Strauss.